Trump has been indicted, shattering norms in the U.S., but globally, charging former leaders is nothing new.
Politicians have misbehaved throughout history, obviously, but I think the taste for that has declined a lot of late.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, Turkish politicians are running for election on this platform. They'll send Syrian refugees back to Syria, a dangerous proposition.
Thinking that the war's over in Syria, the situation is safe, this is simply not true.
And in Argentina, inflation has long been a problem, but now prices are doubling each year.
Primero está el asado, después está la madre, acá en Argentina.
This man says being able to afford asado, the weekend barbecue, is more important to him than his own mother. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The shocking but expected headline today, Trump indicted. Unprecedented for a former American president, but quite common across the globe. Many former heads of state have been tried for crimes. To understand the short and long-term effects of these kinds of prosecutions, we called up James Long, a professor of political science at the University of Washington. Professor Long, how common are prosecutions of former heads of state around the world?
It's not only common already, it's becoming increasingly common, including recently in Brazil, Israel, South Korea, and other countries.
Why does it appear to be something that's on the increase?
Politicians have misbehaved throughout history, obviously, but I think the taste for that has declined a lot of late. Citizens in countries and other elites in countries are growing tired and exhausted of certain ways in which the political class has been seen as corrupt. So right now in France, former President Nicolas Sarkozy has been indicted and actually found guilty. He was accused of and convicted of things related to campaign finance and bribery of a judge. And I think although Sarkozy is the first former president to be found guilty of crimes that he committed while he was president in France, I think there's been the view in France for a long time that the political class is sort of always wheeling and dealing and breaking the rules. And so I think it's a disinclination to put up with people who are breaking the rules. I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is just the information environment that we inhabit now and just the ability to publicize what leaders are doing and put that out there in traditional media and social media. Just knowing that and having that information makes the public a lot more attuned to these issues as well.
Now, just talking to you for a couple of minutes, it's clear that there's a lot of this going on out there. But what's an example of a prosecution of a former leader that went particularly well, that seems to have been a healthy exercise for the country involved?
South Korea. South Korea has undergone investigations, if not outright prosecutions, of five former leaders. And South Korea remains a stable, strong democracy. I also think South Africa is another good example. Once they really started going after Jacob Zuma after he left office, that he sort of saber-rattled with his supporters and tried to kind of influence the politics of it on the street. But that was, you know, tamped down fairly quickly, and the legal proceedings proceeded nonetheless. And South Africa's only been a democracy since 1994.
So what about the other end of this? Can you think of a case that was especially messy and created turmoil and deeper schisms in the country involved?
Brazil. Absolutely, Brazil. Everyone from across the left to the right, you know, every part of the government, the judiciary, the legislature, and the presidency got caught up in decades worth of corruption scandals that once they started to be investigated, then it all kind of depended on who was doing the investigation and who was being investigated. But then it has led to a cycle of prosecutions.
You're referring to the whole mess around Lula and subsequently Dilma Rousseff.
As well as the fact that people on all sides actually have done bad things in Brazil. So it's not just sort of a made up political thing. I mean, there actually is a lot of evidence there on that a lot has gone wrong.
What do you think of the schisms that have been left in Brazil?
I think they're very deep. I think Brazil is a very divided society. Historically, it's been divided by class and race. I think it's now very divided politically. I think it's still very hard to imagine that there could be a successful military coup against one side or the other as there was, you know, up until the 1980s. But I do think at the same time, you know, democracy really is the only game in town right now at a global level. And even though there's been democratic backsliding in certain countries, the movement since the end of World War II has been in the direction of greater and greater democracy.
Are the consequences usually different when it's an elected official versus a former strongman? I'm thinking of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet or someone like that.
Once we go into the realm of non-democracies and dictatorship, then I think you see much wider variation in how prosecutions play out. I mean, in certain cases, prosecutions of a former dictator or something like that by a new dictator perhaps could lead to, you know, the death penalty or exile or anything like that. A country that is much more steeped in dictatorship or has only recently transitioned, they're very concerned about their stability in going after these dictators. At the same time that they're worried about, if we're trying to move out of dictatorship, we have to set an example, and we don't want to make it okay necessarily that everybody from the former political class is essentially given immunity.
James Long is a professor of political science at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
In Turkey, public angst over a crumbling economy has landed on a scapegoat, the roughly 3.6 million Syrian refugees who have come to Turkey over the past decade. With Turkish elections just 6 weeks away, the two main candidates have both promised voters they'll mend ties with Syria's dictator, Bashar al-Assad, and send hundreds of thousands of refugees back to Syria. But as the world's Duri Buscarin reports, Syrians living in Turkey say it's unsafe for them to return.
Back in January, I met Syrian journalist Wala Dell at a tea house in the Turkish border city of Gaziantep.
Kids.
He showed me a video on his cell phone, taken back in Aleppo, where he reported from the scene of an apartment building bombed by the Syrian regime. He helped rescue a child trapped under the rubble that day. 2 years later, an airstrike damaged his home with his own children inside, and that's when he knew it was time to leave Syria. How can we reconcile with a regime like that? Adele said in Arabic. As long as Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad is in power, he can't go back. Then the earthquakes came. On February 6th, massive 7.8 and 7.5 magnitude quakes rocked southern Turkey and northern Syria, killing at least 57,000 people and leaving more than a million homeless. That tea house where Adel used to write his articles was destroyed, but he and his family are safe. One far-right politician shared a video of earthquake survivors accusing Syrian refugees of stealing supplies, a claim that was quickly refuted by his own party, but regurgitated by newspapers and talk shows. With food and shelter in short supply, the disaster unleashed a new wave of anti-refugee hatred in Turkey. In another city, a Syrian man was beaten while trying to rescue his own children from the ruins of his home. Onlookers had accused him of looting.
I'm always afraid for my family members. You know, whenever there's an incident involving Syrians and Turks, I'm always on edge.
In Istanbul, a Syrian refugee named Isra asks not to use her full name. She's lived in Turkey long enough to qualify for citizenship here, but her husband has not. And she's worried that depending on how the elections turn out on May 14th, he could be deported back to Syria, and she could be stripped of her citizenship.
We've all been fearing the election. Before, you know, rhetoric against Syrians was restricted to small opposition parties, but right now this has been filtered to the main opposition bloc.
Isra changed her headscarf to a Turkish style. She speaks Turkish, not Arabic, in public. In the early days of the Syrian civil war, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan welcomed Syrian refugees, but relatively few moved on to be resettled in Europe and North America. As the war dragged on, Turkey found itself hosting 3.6 million refugees amid an economic downturn. Many felt the refugees were putting a strain on Turkey's hospitals and schools. Public opinion shifted, and hate crimes against refugees increased. Both Turkey's ruling party and main opposition bloc have promised Turkish voters that they will send Syrians back to Syria if elected, a claim that human rights monitors say is incredibly dangerous.
Thinking that the war's over in Syria, the situation is safe, this is simply not true.
Emma Sinclair Webb leads the Human Rights Watch program for Turkey. The organization has followed many refugees who returned to Syria in recent years after living abroad. She says it's most dangerous for families connected to the Syrian opposition.
People go missing, they get tortured, they get detained. We know from our own research that the situation is not safe for returnees en masse.
But for many Turkish voters, it's something they'd like to see. At the height of the refugee crisis, the Islamic State carried out deadly bombings in Turkey, which made it feel like the war had spilled over the border. Rabia, a housewife in Gaziantep, says she sees Syrians as neighbors. She wants Turkey to be a place where people can be safe from war. But she also saw how an influx of refugees willing to work for lower salaries made it hard for Turkish workers to compete.
İnşallah düzelir Suriye. Temennimiz o.
I'd like the war to end, she says, and I want life to go back to how it was before. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin in Istanbul.
Among the many countries supporting the war effort in Ukraine, the Czech Republic stands out. It was the very first country to supply tanks to the Ukrainian military after Russia's invasion last year. But the NATO member state isn't just sending heavy machinery. Morgan Childs reports from Prague.
The Czech company Inflatech manufactures all kinds of military equipment, like tanks, planes, and missile launchers.
So this is anti-aircraft system in a NATO code SA-8.
CEO Wojciech Fresser is showing me videos featuring his company's products in action. And here's what they've all got in common. These war machines are actually inflatable decoys.
If you need to spend a dollar for a bullet or for inflatable toy, what is more peaceful? We offer something that can't hurt nobody, but it can resolve the conflict. And moreover, it can stop the conflict before the conflict becomes real.
Fresser says many commonly used anti-tank missiles cost upwards of $80,000. His company's inflatables cost less than half that. So if one is damaged or destroyed, it's not a major loss. The enemy, however, will have wasted valuable equipment trying to destroy fake machinery. Fresser won't confirm exactly where these products are going, but he does admit that business has been especially busy over the past year, suggesting that Ukraine might be a recipient. Marina Myron is a researcher at the War Studies Department of King's College London. She says deception in warfare is nothing new. Within the Russian military context, the term of art is maskirovka.
The idea of maskirovka is to deceive your enemy into taking a certain action that is favorable to your forces. It requires knowing your enemy and knowing how your enemy thinks, and then trying to shift that perception. So in US terminology, it's called perception management.
By successfully deploying decoys, Myron says, Ukraine is beating Russia at its own game.
It's the Russians who are very famous for being able to be good at these kinds of things, you know, throughout history. And now the Ukrainians are kind of saying, well, you know, you fell for it.
Czech reporter Wojciech Bohacz spent time on the ground with Ukrainian soldiers in Bakhmut earlier this year. He says they're keenly aware of the advantage that Russian forces have when it comes to resources.
They told us that they see that Russia can fire like 200 missiles at the same time when Ukrainians can fire just one. Even if they are not precise, if they are not trained very well, in the end they can destroy everything, while Ukrainians does not have this capacity.
The Czech Republic has been an enthusiastic ally of Ukraine ever since Russia invaded last February. According to Bohacz, that's because Czechs remember the Warsaw Pact invasion, when Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia in 1968, putting an end to the Prague Spring.
It was like, okay, there is a smaller country which was attacked without any provocation. We know it from the past somehow, and we should be here to help the country, because otherwise we can be the next one.
In fact, Czech support for Ukraine is so strong that Wojciech Fresser and his company Inflatech have been getting kudos from the public.
We receive a lot of thank you letters and messages, and I believe we will enjoy these feelings maybe later when we will be able more to relax. Now it's really hard because a lot of lives depend on our products.
Over the last year, the Czech Republic has provided dozens of tanks to Ukraine. There's also a crowdfunding campaign that's raising cash for a mobile rocket launcher. The effort calls itself A Gift for Putin. For The World, I'm Morgan Childs in Prague.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A decade of war and now devastating earthquakes have left much of Syria reduced to rubble. Concrete and bricks in piles where buildings and homes once stood. Here's one glimmer of good news. A new study says that rubble can possibly be used to speed up the rebuilding process. John Provis is a materials scientist at the University of Sheffield in the UK. John, your study looked at the idea of recycling rubble to make new buildings. How would that work exactly?
The idea for this study actually came from the colleagues from Syria and had been displaced by the conflict there. And they'd looked at essentially the amount of waste material that had resulted from the wars. And they said, instead of bringing in new materials to make the concrete we need to rebuild here, why can't we use this? So we started working with them to develop essentially a plan to use the materials that were there to make high quality, reliable engineering materials for reconstruction in place.
That's incredible. So can you just kind of pick up a piece of rubble and prepare it in a way to make a new batch of concrete, or do you have to sort through the rubble to get certain parts of it?
It's much more complicated than just picking it up. It needs to be the right materials, good quality, strong. It needs to be clean. A large part of what we were doing was making it easy enough to do. So how much of the quality control do you actually need to do in really, really detailed ways? And how much can you do with fairly simple techniques, fairly simple processes that you can use on site in an area that doesn't have a lot of infrastructure?
So were you able to build a kind of batch of concrete using old rubble and test it by making something?
The laboratory test work was all done between Syria and Turkey. The Syrian colleagues had been displaced into Turkey. They traveled back into Syria to collect rubble from the damaged cities there and brought it to the testing facilities in Turkey, producing concrete elements, running all the tests we needed to run to say, this is a good quality concrete. The colleagues in Syria are working very actively. It's a really challenging situation for them at the moment because the colleagues in that northern region of Syria who've already been displaced by war, the earthquake has just hit the same region as well. So all of these issues are compounding on each other, which in some ways further reinforces the need for excellent high-quality materials to be produced out of this type of project.
To get a sense of this, I mean, how much rubble exists in Syria now? I mean, what's the potential here?
There are entire cities lying in ruins. That is a tragedy. But there is the need to rebuild everything that's in those cities. And so that's an opportunity to rebuild using high-quality materials, using, in some cases, better earthquake-resistant construction techniques, so that the future of these cities, based on the materials that are in large part already there, can be a lot more sustainable in multiple senses of that word.
Do you think that what you're finding out about the ability to use rubble to rebuild, can those techniques be used in other parts of the world that are affected by earthquakes or war?
Absolutely. The use of recycled concrete and recycling of old demolition waste into concretes is not anything new, to be honest. But the scientific steps that we were making in this one and the engineering advances, finding the materials on site and cleaning them up in an appropriate way is something that I think we can transfer more broadly into other scenarios, other settings.
John Provis is a materials scientist at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
And thank you very much.
This week, a new series of short films based on traditional African folktales premiered in Nairobi. They also premiered on Netflix, which is behind the project. From the Kenyan capital, The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi brings us more.
If you watch the trailer for this series, it's very Hollywood. But at the heart of this series is Africa. These are African folktales reimagined Tendeka Matatu is the director of film in Africa at Netflix.
We've got 6 short films from 6 different countries. So from Mauritania, from Uganda, from Kenya, from Tanzania, from South Africa, and from Nigeria. And each of the stories really speaks to something that is specific and local to those countries.
The anthology was created in partnership with UNESCO. It's been putting a spotlight on the potential of Africa's film industries. But African filmmakers face a lot of challenges in getting their stories on screen. These films are the result of an Africa-wide contest that received around 2,000 submissions. I asked Matatu why they decided to focus on folktales for this project.
Folktales have always been an important way of passing culture and heritage and the values, you know, from generation to generation. And our partnership with Netflix is really built on the joint goal of, like, celebrating African storytelling and celebrating heritage.
Kenyan heritage is the inspiration behind Volin Ogutu's film Anyango and the Ogre. Yes, ogre, as in those giant, ugly monsters that devour humans.
It was just this fun, scary story about an ogre that is determined to eat children. But then the children have been taught a song by their mom or their dad in some stories to make sure they don't open for the ogre by mistake.
Ogutu tells me this tale is one she heard many times as a child.
This is a story I grew up hearing. This is a story that were in exam papers at some point. Growing up, we had literature classes, and we would have different folktales within those exam papers.
In her short film, Ogutu puts a futuristic spin on the classic folktale. She also makes it a story about a woman dealing with gender-based violence.
The ogre represents not just the man who is tormenting her and her kids. It also represents the society that is reinforcing that environment and kind of making women feel like they have to stay in such environments to endure several ogres in their lives.
Another one of the films in this anthology comes from the West African country of Mauritania. That's where filmmaker Mohamed Eshkuna is from. His short film is inspired by jinns, or genies, as they're known in some parts of the world.
Jinn in Islam in general, or how the way we view them in West Africa, where I grew up, is there these hidden spirits that do not interact with humans, but there are these stories of humans using them for either evil or good.
I asked Eshkuna what he thinks the purpose of these jinn folktales are.
I remember, like, all of these stories are usually at the end, there is some sort of a lesson. At the end of every story, it's basically, don't do this to your brother, or don't do this to your sister, or friends shouldn't be like that. So there's always, like, a moral at the end of these stories that children learn from.
Eshkuna tells me he grew up in the Sahara Desert, in a village of about 15 families. He says he didn't watch his first film until he was about 12 years old. So being on Netflix is a big deal.
We haven't seen, like, a Mauritanian story, authentic story told from, like, Mauritanian voice, super deeply rooted in the culture, also with Mauritanian music in parts of it, and clothing and everything.
The 6-part series, African Folktales Reimagined, premiered on Netflix this week. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi. More stories ahead. You're listening to The World. Across the British Isles, more and more leaders are of South Asian descent.
My young niece will grow up seeing this as a normality, that anything is possible.
A moment of great pride for people of color, and also a complex moment. Plus, a visit to the Museum of Failure. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For most of us, the idea of dying is pretty scary, especially the thought of dying alone. For the homeless, that's a real fear. In Spain, social workers estimate that dozens of people die outside each year, often by themselves. But in Madrid, a small group of people is trying to make a difference. Reporter Jerry Haddon brings us the story of one terminally ill homeless woman as she navigates the end of her life with some help she never expected.
Vicky, no last names please, she says, is Dominican. When she was a kid, her mom left home to work, leaving her with her dad and 13 brothers.
No sé si fue por no tener madre al lado o qué, I don't know if it was because my mom wasn't around or just living with so many men. These aren't excuses, mind you, but I slept with a guy and got pregnant.
Vicky was just 11 years old. From there, as she tells it, her life went off the rails.
It's
not like here in Spain, where a dad says, don't do this, don't do that, you know, end of story. Back home, my dad beat me when he found out. I was nearly 2 months pregnant, and I had a miscarriage.
During Vicky's teenage years, she says, she had another miscarriage, two abortions, and then she lost a child to violence.
So one day a gunfight broke out between street gangs. My three-year-old son and some other kids started running for cover, but a stray bullet hit him. I'm still scarred by it. He was my boy.
Vicky's 52 years old now. Her mom brought her here to Spain decades ago to try to turn her life around. Vicky can only walk short distances before she's out of breath and needs to sit. She has advanced lung cancer and breast cancer and a tumor behind one eye. She's telling me her story in a Madrid park. Nearby, children play on a playground.
Is it my fault for drinking and smoking? I asked the doctors. They said it spread and grew because I didn't follow the treatment or even go to my doctor's appointments.
Vicky says she had one round of chemo for the breast cancer, but at that point she was living on the streets, an alcoholic, and the treatment left her confused and weak. And that's about when she met Soleil Gallego, a hospice volunteer with a group called 38 Degrees.
Una quimioterapia si no estás en algún sitio es muy complicado.
If you're sick and have no home, Gallego says, and you get treatment like chemotherapy, it can be very complicated. You're out vomiting on the sidewalk, maybe you're in severe pain, she says, but you have no access to painkillers. It's terrible. Once a week, Gallego visits with Vicky, often here in this park. They met through a small hospice care facility funded by the community of Madrid. It's called Hogar Sí, or Yes to a Home.
I didn't need money for cigarettes or booze. What I really needed was a hug, for someone to say to me, easy now, you can keep going. Soleil's hugs fill me with such joy. It's indescribable.
We need to remember, Gallego says, her arm around Vicky, that there's a human being behind the person you see on the street. No matter what their story is, she says, these are still people. Hogar Sí, the hospice home, is just across the street from the park. It's six row houses with 10 sick residents in each one. On a recent morning, Vicky's preparing lunch for her roommates, slicing onions, frying up garlic for a veggie stew.
Last night, the man in the room next to mine got really sick. It was so sad. Many times when the ambulance takes them away in the night like that, they never come back. But anyway, that's what this disease does.
The incident has Vicky thinking of her years on the street before a hospital referred her here, and of a friend, a homeless man named Antonio. She says over time, Antonio became like a father to her, showing her the ropes, where to sleep, eat, shower. He protected her.
One morning I nudged him. I said, Antonio, wake up. We need to get to the church for pastries, otherwise we'll miss out. I thought he was asleep, so I went alone. When they came back carrying our food, I saw the ambulances and the police. Antonio was dead.
Vicky says that's when she decided to get off the street, no matter what. As luck would have it, soon after, a bed opened up here in the hospice center.
I don't know what I would have done otherwise. Antonio's death hit me hard, seeing him dead on the street like a dog. I wondered, what are they going to do with his body? Where will they take him? I almost went crazy.
Those questions haunt homeless people, and there are lots of them in Madrid. 1,600 by the city's count. Among them is Francisco, who on a recent morning is drinking with other guys on a busy square downtown. I used to work in the vineyards, he tells me, and here I am drinking wine to stay warm. I have a terrible disease, he says, picking at a line of purple scabs on his forearm. I've been on the street now for a year and a half, he says. I have HIV, he confides. Do you have the medicine you're supposed to take, I ask him. No, he says. The problem is that I drink, then screw everything up. But I am scared, he says. I'm scared. Back at the Hogar C hospice home, Vicky's fears are on hold, for a moment at least. She's just learned that Soleil Gallegos, the hospice volunteer, has managed to grant her a sort of last wish.
Soleil is one of a kind. You can just feel how noble she is talking to her. I'm so nervous, but until I have the tickets in hand, I just won't believe it.
Vicky's going home to the Dominican Republic to visit her elderly mom and family. It's just 2 weeks, as doctors here insist she stick with her cancer treatment, but it's given her, as has this homeless hospice program, the unimaginable at this stage of her life. Something to look forward to. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid, Spain.
In Scotland, history was made when Hamza Yousaf became Scotland's first minister earlier this week.
It is a really proud day for me and my family. I hope it's also a proud day for Scotland, as it speaks to our values as a country, as I stand here as the first ever Muslim to lead a Western democratic nation.
These types of moments are spreading across the British Isles. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is also part of the South Asian community, as is Prime Minister Leo Varadkar next door in Ireland. Natasha Junejo is founder of the group South Asian Writers and is host of the Decolonial podcast. She joins us from London. Natasha, did you ever imagine you'd be living in this moment when so many of the top political leaders in the British Isles claim South Asian heritage?
No, actually, I didn't at all. Growing up, this was not a picture I imagined seeing as a small child. So many people that looked just like me in these positions of prestige and power and having such a direct hand in running our country.
What does this mean to the South Asian community?
I think there are sort of two ways of looking at this. I think to children of colour and to South Asian children growing up, this fabric of the society that they will see reflected back to them is extraordinary. It's unprecedented for third culture kids that have grown up within this system, whose parents came here one generation or two generations ago. But the other way of looking at this, I think, becomes more complex. I think that the party that we have in power now is a very conservative government. It's extremely punitive in terms of its foreign policy, in terms of how it protects the weak and the vulnerable. I think it's important to look at each of these people's identity as South Asian, absolutely, but there are other intersections of their identity that then also comes into play.
Is there a way for you to contrast how South Asian immigrants were treated when they first started coming in the late 40s, you know, through to the 60s, and this moment we're in now where South Asians are emerging as major political leaders?
It was a great deal more forceful, I think. Xenophobia still exists, obviously. Racism still exists. Institutional and structural racism still exists, absolutely. But the forceful, brutish nature of what our parents and grandparents faced has lessened to some degree. However, there are so many other things to unpick now that are embedded in society, that are embedded in society against marginalized communities and people. But having said that as well, I find it so intriguing that we have a South Asian Prime Minister of the Conservative Party. And when our parents in the 60s, when Enoch Powell was in power, he was a Tory and he was notoriously racist. And their campaign at the time was incredibly racist against Black people and South Asian people. And they used racial slurs in their campaign flyers, saying that if you want X as a neighbor, vote Labour. If you don't, then vote Tory. And that's how overt it was at the time. It was unabashed racism.
So what I'm curious about is how the South Asian community in Britain and Ireland became so politically engaged.
I think one of the main catalysts was the Brexit vote. It was the EU referendum in 2016. And I think around that point, I think growing up as a marginalized person in a marginalized community and a minority, we thought we kind of were moving along with racism and we'd outgrown a great deal of what we went through in the 80s and the 90s. But within 24 hours of that EU referendum vote, social media feeds were awash with people's stories of racist incidents.
Does the Brexit vote track with when Hamza Yousaf and Rishi Sunak got involved in politics?
They've been involved for a long, long time. I think their political careers are something that they've always had in mind, particularly Rishi Sunak. I think it was a natural progression for him. And I think when we talk about class with Rishi Sunak, he was incredibly privileged. His net worth is £730 million. His wife is a billionaire as well. And he was part of the Tory party for a very, very, very long time.
Finally, do you expect more South Asians will look to get involved in politics in the years ahead in Britain and Ireland?
Oh, I hope so. I really do. I hope so. I think it's a wonderful thing. For me, I want to see everybody represented. I want to see more trans people in politics. I want to see far more women in politics. I want to see every intersection of every identity that we have represented in a way that gives that community power and gives that community a voice and gives that community a seat at the table.
Natasha Janejo is the founder of the group South Asian Writers. She's also the host of the Decolonial podcast. She's been speaking to us from London. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
High inflation has long haunted Argentina's economy, but price increases are now reaching excruciating levels. The annual inflation rate topped 100% in February, the highest in 30 years. Only a handful of countries with collapsing economies, like Lebanon or Venezuela, have it worse. Alain Ruiz Terol reports on some of the impacts of Argentine inflation from Buenos Aires.
At a butcher shop in Buenos Aires, price tags change every day to account for the rampant inflation. The owner, Martin Riente, shakes his head in dismay. He's 43 and has been in the business since the age of 17. He's never seen prices increase so much and so quickly. A year ago, he was selling milanesas, a typical meat dish, for 1,000 pesos a kilo, about $9, although exchange rates vary greatly. Now, milanesas sell for almost 3,000 pesos. Not being able to afford meat is one of the worst things that could happen to an Argentine, he says. The asado, a weekend barbecue with family and friends, is a national institution. Riente says that in Argentina, first comes the asado and then comes your mother. And yet, it's not only the meat. At a vegetable store nearby, Fernando Basbus, the owner, says a kilo of lettuce sells for about $3.
Me parece que es un disparate, pero no hay. Vas a comprar lechuga y no hay.
He says
no
it's crazy, vale. But it's in short supply, so it gets expensive. Basbus is 70, and in theory he retired, but continues to work. Like many Argentines, he keeps his savings in U.S. dollars for fear of devaluation.
Otra cosa, ahorrar en pesos no sirve. No tiene sentido.
Saving in Argentine pesos is worthless, he says. If you keep 10, tomorrow you have 8, and the day after you have 6, so it doesn't make sense. The pandemic, the war in Ukraine, the ongoing drought, they all dealt blows to the Argentine economy. But the root causes of inflation run deeper, to the country's huge debt and the difficulties in financing it. Throughout the years, governments have come and gone, promising to tackle inflation, each with their own recipe, but largely failing.
Y la inflación no es ni más ni menos que la fiebre de una economía enferma.
Current Finance Minister Sergio Massa called inflation the fever of a sick economy at a rally in January. Since then, the fever has only gotten worse. Back at the butcher shop, one of the clients, Claudia Chaid, cannot recall a time in her 53 years of age when inflation was not a concern. All my life, I've heard about inflation, she says. It's endemic, never going away, forever living with us. It's madness. It's like a mental war one wages all the time, racing against numbers, she says. Chait's salary as a teacher has increased, but not enough to match inflation. Still, she says others are in a far worse situation.
Tengo fe que lo que vaya a venir sea mejor, aunque va a tardar años.
I do have faith in a better future, she says, however long it may take. the country is very rich in natural resources. But on the other hand, she expects this to be a tough year, with an election around the corner. She hopes the next government can fix the situation, but admits that it may take some magic trick. For the world, I'm Alan Rusterol, Buenos Aires.
The city of Vancouver in Canada is playing host to an uninvited guest, a sculpture of a giant spider. It popped up one night under an East Vancouver overpass, and believe me when I tell you, this thing is terrifying. From a distance, it looks real, like a mutant arachnid.
A gigantic beast, dotting the earth, crushing all before it in a cyclonic cavalcade of electrifying horror. Raging.
But beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
We really like it. Need more.
CBC News has been polling Vancouver residents.
We hope it stays there for a long time.
But the spider's days could be numbered. The city is threatening to take it down. Vancouver City Councillor Peter Meisner spoke to CTV News.
It's got tons of people talking, which is the whole point of public art. But the problem with it, unfortunately, is that they didn't go through the public art process that the city has.
The artist, known only as Junko, has launched a social media campaign called Help Save Spidey. Supporters have stepped up. Many of them are contacting city officials and telling them to chill out and get a sense of humor. So far, no dice. The city plans to go ahead with the removal, which will likely be a long and complex process, leaving the spider sculpture tangled in a web of municipal bureaucracy. In India, police are on the trail for a self-styled preacher who has revived calls for an independent homeland for Sikhs. Amritpal Singh is leading the movement to establish Khalistan. He's been on the run for nearly 2 weeks now. From Mumbai, Raksha Kumar reports on the manhunt that's elevated a little-known preacher into a household name.
Amritpal Singh has been playing cat and mouse with the police for days. In a video he released Friday, he says he is not a fugitive and that he would decide when he would surrender. Singh gave no indication when that might be, but appealed to Sikhs to stand by him. Since escaping arrest nearly 2 weeks ago, TV channels have breathlessly reported on Singh's whereabouts, often blurring the line between facts and rumor. The nation, though, is transfixed.
These are the visuals on your screen. The police officials seen there. It was a very, very dramatic sequence of events yesterday. The police officials working on a tip-off trying to arrest Amritpal Singh.
Singh's separatist ideas have made the authorities nervous because India has had a violent history of Sikh separatism. Sikhs are the majority community in the state of Punjab.
Pijedi self-determination hai.
Self-determination is our birthright, says Singh in a video. However, today, Sikhs living in India generally do not support the idea of a separate nation. The idea finds more support among the 2 million Sikhs spread across the UK, the US, Canada and Australia. Sangeet Toor is an editor of a Punjabi magazine on farmers' rights. She lived in the US for many years and is back in India.
If you talk to Punjabis here, it's like, that's fine. He should have been arrested. For Punjabis abroad, he has become an icon, and this incident has made him a bigger icon.
Many here are old enough to remember what happened when six separatist militants and the security forces clashed in the 1970s and 80s. Singh styles himself on a charismatic six separatist leader, Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale, who was killed by the Indian Army. In retaliation, the then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated. After that, the nation saw large-scale violence against Sikhs. Thousands were killed, many were maimed and tortured. Those that remember this violence are wary of separatism, but the younger people of Punjab have not seen those days, and some of them support Singh.
And of course, for any inflammatory ideas, for any inflammatory narrative, you're going to get a lot of people behind you, because when there is illiteracy, when there are no opportunities for anyone to look forward to. Again, I'm talking about the bigger problems that we are having in Punjab today.
Among the bigger problems in Punjab is the high rate of drug abuse. And Amritpal Singh has blamed the authorities for not doing enough to control it. If he had a separate country, Singh says he would do better. Here he is speaking to local media just before he fled.
Do you see the drug genocide epidemic here? Every village has 20 to 25 guys who got, and some villages has 80 guys who get with overdose. Who is controlling the drug? Who has responsibility to end this epidemic? Who is not taking any actions?
Ashutosh Kumar, a professor of politics at Punjab University, says that a separate country is not the answer. Moreover, Punjab's problems have deeper economic roots. Punjab is one of the largest producers of food grains in India. But, he says, the agriculture sector is in deep crisis.
The soil quality has gone down, the water table has gone down, the farmers are debt-ridden, and the industries are not coming. You know, so investments not taking place in Punjab. So youth is completely disillusioned.
And because of that disillusionment, it's not surprising that many of the people who helped Singh escape were born long after that violent time. For The World, I'm Raksha Kumar.
Museums are often curated to show off the world's best, whether it's fine art, fashion, science, or just esoterica. But that is decidedly not what you'll find if you walk into the museum featured in this next story. The World's Bianca Hillier first told us about it last summer.
For many people, the idea of failing isn't a laughing matter. But when other people come up short and their products are on display at the Museum of Failure, it's a whole different ballgame.
It is often funny because some of the things are just so stupid. So.
Samuel West is a clinical psychologist and innovation researcher. He started the Museum of Failure in Sweden back in 2017. Inside, visitors will find more than 150 products, including beef-flavored bottled water for dogs, Harley Davidson perfume,
legendary Harley Davidson, aux toilettes pour hommes,
and a golf club that doubles as a urinal. It's called the Euro Club, and it even ended up on Shark Tank, where entrepreneurs pitch their ideas.
If you've been on a golf course, I won't have to convince you that a tree's a sparse and the bathrooms are almost non-existent.
I can't wait.
I see where this is going.
Believe it or not, that golf club is still on the market. Since the museum's launch, the collection has traveled to L.A., Paris, Taipei, and Calgary, to name a few. Founder Samuel West says many of the items stay the same, but some are switched out.
For example, some of the American brands, they're totally not recognizable in China. Lifesavers is one.
Lifesavers, the hard ring-shaped candy.
So Lifesavers launched a candy that was the Lifesaver holes, like donut holes, but Lifesaver holes.
The huge taste of Lifesavers candy in tiny, delicious little bites.
Yeah, that one was a failure, but the Chinese market doesn't even know what Lifesavers are, so wouldn't work.
Market recognition isn't always a prerequisite. To make it into the museum, the product has to be a failure, of course.
But it also has to be an innovation. So it has to be what people actually were pushing the boundaries.
West says he always has his eyes open for failed products and companies. But the museum's collection mostly comes through donations.
I probably get 2 donations a month. Sometimes it comes from ex-employees from the companies. And then I've been contacted by companies that offered to send their competition's products to the museum.
One product recently donated to the museum is the Unobrush.
It's a revolutionary toothbrush. You stick it in your mouth, then it super vibrates for 10 seconds and supposedly cleans your entire mouth in 10 seconds. The problem is it doesn't actually work.
West laughs, but says all of these companies deserve credit for taking risks with innovative products. At the end of the day, the museum isn't about making fun of the inventions. It's about using them to normalize failure.
I wish people would understand that the rewards of taking a risk are far greater than the pain or discomfort of failure.
He knows failure isn't necessarily a positive thing, but it can be worthwhile. And maybe worthy of a joke or two. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.